Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the show, Wyoming has re-upped its contract with a nonprofit that's operating out of state to stop the early closure of coal plants. Locals there have been surprised to hear another state was intervening there. Wyoming officials say they're not shy about it.
Certainly have never given EPN the okay to go ahead and talk about its relationship with Wyoming.
A year after the police killing of Anderson Antelope in Riverton, his family is still asking for greater transparency.
That really took a big old blow, you know. It really hurt me a lot, you know, and it still hurts to this day.
And we'll also go on an adventure to a Beartooth Mountain glacier to learn how Rocky Mountain locusts and glacier stories intertwine. Join us for those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. It's been a year since a Riverton police officer shot and killed 58-year-old Anderson Antelope, a citizen of the Northern Arapaho Tribe. The Fremont County Attorney's Office ruled the shooting necessary and justified. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr reports, some community members are still asking for greater transparency.
Growing up, Levina Antelope and her little brother Andy were close. She calls him the baby of the family, even though he wasn't the youngest. She says he was funny and tender-hearted. But in his final years, Andy Antelope struggled with severe alcoholism. Levina worried her brother's addiction would kill him. She never imagined she would lose him to police violence.
I had a lot of deaths in my family, But you know what? This is the first time a family member has ever died of a gunshot.
On September 21st, 2019, a Riverton police officer was trying to arrest Andy Antelope for public intoxication. According to a report from the Wyoming Division of Criminal Investigation, or DCI, Antelope wouldn't comply. When the officer tried to physically move him from the picnic table where he was sitting, Antelope pulled a knife on the officer and attacked him with it. The officer ordered Antelope to drop the knife. When he refused, the officer shot Antelope in the head at close range.
That really took a big old blow, you know. It really hurt me a lot, you know, and it still hurts to this day.
2 months after Antelope's death, Riverton Police Chief Eric Murphy called it tragic but unavoidable.
It's very unfortunate what happened. But what everybody needs to realize is Anderson Antelope made this decision, not the officer. When he pulled out that knife and shoved it in our officer's chest, he made that decision.
But Antelope only tried to shove a knife into the officer's chest. Thanks to an armored vest, the officer was unharmed. And Antelope's family members have doubts about whether he could have posed a real physical threat. He was 58 years old and in bad health, largely because of his addiction. He had poor balance and struggled to get around without help. Still, after reviewing the DCI report, Fremont County Attorney Patrick LeBrun ruled that the officer acted lawfully and in self-defense. Levina Antelope was counting on the opportunity to review the evidence herself at an inquest planned by the Fremont County Coroner's Office. But that inquest was suspended.
To me, everything is just like a big cover-up, you know, for the officer that shot and killed my brother. It's just like they're sweeping everything underneath the rug. They don't want the truth to come out. That's what I'm thinking, and that's what a lot of people are thinking.
Justice for Andy!
Public inquest now!
Justice for Andy!
A year to the day after Antelope's death, about 50 community members marched through Riverton demanding that same inquest. The hope is that it would provide a forum outside the criminal justice system for the public to consider the circumstances surrounding Antelope's death. Not just whether the shooting was legal, but how and why a public nuisance call ended with a man being shot in the head. Coroner's inquests don't happen often, but they are allowed under Wyoming state law. Fremont County Coroner Mark Stratmone is a strong advocate for inquests as an accountability tool, especially when someone is killed by the police.
Because, and it's obvious in the contemporary and recent history of the country, that transparency is an important aspect of those incidents.
But Fremont County Attorney Patrick LeBrun opposed an inquest into Antelope's death. in part because the criminal justice system had already reached a determination in the case.
The purpose of a coroner's inquest is to determine cause and manner of death. In this case, the cause and manner of death was never in dispute.
LeBrun says allowing the jury to consider whether the shooting was justified would be improper. He also points out that Stratmone's inquest wouldn't have followed some of the rules meant to ensure fairness in a criminal trial, like impartial jury selection and cross-examination.
He carries on and he says, well, it's not adversarial, so my process is different. Well, the thing is, it is the adversarial process that gets to the truth.
Stratmone says it's by design that a coroner's inquest operates differently than a criminal trial. Still, with city and county attorneys refusing to cooperate, Stratmone had to suspend it. If the inquest had been allowed to go on, Stratmone says it might have provided some closure.
That sort of transparency and understanding can a lot of times prevent further public questions and disruptions down the line.
Riverton resident Larry Wallace is one of the demonstrators still asking for an inquest. He knew Andy Antelope personally, knew his physical limitations, and he thinks it's possible the shooting was justified. He just finds it strange that city and county officials would stand against a public airing of the facts.
We need questions to be answered. We need honesty. And we need a plan to move forward which will help to prevent tragedies like this from happening again.
After Antelope's death, the Riverton Police Department purchased body cameras. Chief Eric Murphy hopes the cameras will protect his officers from accusations of misconduct. He also says his department and the county attorney's office have been fully transparent and that further probing of the case isn't necessary. It's not clear whether a coroner's inquest would have satisfied the Antelope family's questions about their relative's death, but they say it would have been an earnest attempt. Levina Antelope says the inquest should go on. Not just for her brother's sake, but to set a precedent.
We don't want anybody to go through the hurt that we went through. And I tell you what, it's a hurt that's going to sink in, and I don't think it'll ever go away.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr.
The Defender Aid Clinic at the University of Wyoming's College of Law is behind a new podcast that dives into the racial disparities in the United States criminal justice system. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen spoke with law professor Lauren McLean and student Nathan Yonchek, who says the podcast grew out of the outrage he and students in the clinic felt over police killings of African-American men.
You know, as students, we've always been, especially in the Defender Aid Clinic, we've been outraged over these police killings of African-American men. And that's actually one of the reasons I even went to law school after the events in Ferguson, Missouri, and just sort of how things played out over time, as well as reading Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. I realized just sort of how profoundly unfair the criminal justice system is to African-Americans. And as you have just sort of like a continuous protest movement since Ferguson with the Black Lives Matter movement, these killings have become even more outrageous as time has passed, because I think a lot of people sort of in my position as like a white male become to realize how bad it all is. So every time we see another incident happen, we get more and more outraged and want something to change, want something to be done about it. And then in these recent instances when George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery were killed by police or former police, you know, this recent surge of protest, especially in these sort of, you know, turbulent times we live in, has really kind of compelled us to try to do something about it. And I know in as far as like direct action is concerned, it's kind of hard to take direct action from time to time. And we felt that in our capacity as a defender aid clinic, as public defenders, particularly people who kind of push back against police and side with criminal defendants constantly, that we were in a good position to actually educate the public and educate people on these issues, and that people might give us a little more of a, pay more attention to what we have to say than otherwise they would have if we were just, you know, typing out a screed on Facebook or something like that.
This would probably be a good question for you, Lauren, but, you know, I imagine some listeners may not know about UW's Defender Aid Clinic. So can you explain what it is? It seems sort of unique to campus in that it directly deals with the justice system on a regular basis.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, we are very much so public defenders in the Defender Aid Clinic. The students who enroll in the Defender Aid Clinic want to be public defenders for the most part, or at least trial attorneys. They want to be in the courtroom and are very passionate about these issues related to justice, systemic problems in the criminal justice system. And so we are best suited, I believe, for this podcast because we do have the experience and the knowledge to share with our community. And beyond that, what we see pretty much every single day in the courtrooms and in our work and in our research and just the cases and information that we are regularly exposed to or studying on a routine basis.
And what will listeners hear on this podcast that, you know, might surprise them?
I think one thing that I can think of is just how people don't seem to connect the law and how it supports perpetuating these racial disparities in our system. A lot of people, especially lay people, tend to see the law as this objective force and not as this sort of political tool that helps perpetuate the status quo, which is racial disparity and at times overt racism. I think people would be surprised at just how complicit the court has been. And it hasn't really been along the 5-4 political lines, though it has been a lot of the times. It's also been unanimously supported by all the justices on the Supreme Court, for instance, supporting cases that have been terrible for African Americans and other minorities.
So, but I would absolutely concur with Nathan that the most shocking information that will probably be revealed by this podcast is how deeply ingrained these issues are and how the U.S. Supreme Court has had a hand in all of this, including justices that we love and respect. You know, there was a unanimous court decision in 1996 in Rim v. United States that authorized the pretextual traffic stop and simply discarded or ignored the substantial risk of racial profiling happening during a pretextual stop. And that's all 9 justices who signed on to that opinion. In the height of mass incarceration, the war on drugs, all those things, as we look to the literature that's out there now about that time error, there was plenty of information to demonstrate to the court that they should not have proceeded in a colorblind fashion, and yet they did. So it's really people that we respect, that we hold in high regard, that have allowed these things to continue, have allowed longstanding racism, quite frankly, in the criminal justice system. And that, to me, is always shocking every time I come back to this area.
And is there anything else you want listeners to know about the podcast?
Yeah, and what I think is unique about Wyoming and particularly the students on our campus is that we really do challenge one another in our belief systems and our ideologies and listen to one another. And so we hope to craft a community of listeners that is similar. I mean, there's certainly going to be episodes that are going to rip you apart inside, are going to be devastating to you to hear about. And there'll be other episodes where you might say, well, I don't know if I agree with that. And so we really welcome an open forum or discussion on these issues. I mean, part of this is just getting people to talk and raise awareness about this and listen to one another. I mean, that's what's missing right now, right? Is nobody's listening to anybody. You have a far right and a far left. And I think most of us can agree that 90%+ of the time we could really meet in the middle. And so we hope that our podcast offers that opportunity to really have well-informed, respectful, comprehensive discourse on these issues.
The podcast Justice Talks in Wyoming from UW's Defender Aid Clinic launched October 1st. It's available anywhere you can download or listen to podcasts. Thanks so much to the both of you.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thanks for all that you do too, Maggie.
Yeah, thank you, Maggie. It was a pleasure.
When we come back, we will have a couple of COVID-19 related stories from the region. This is Open Spaces.
This time on The Modern West, we'll go looking for the ghosts of an old silver mining town to see if they can teach us about the cycles of boom and bust.
Why are people so fascinated by ghost towns anyway?
I guess it's just the thought that people actually lived here, made a home.
Bus Town. It's part two of our ghost hunting series. Find the Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. We've been hearing a lot about public health departments and their essential role in responding to the pandemic. What you might not know, though, is that historically, many public health departments have formed alliances. But in one part of our region, the strain of the pandemic is forcing one of those alliances apart. The Mountain West News Bureau's Ray Ellen Bichel reports.
The Tri-County Health Department in Colorado is a marriage between three counties in the Denver area, and it began with a devastating flood more than 50 years ago. Laura Thomas remembers it vividly.
I remember sitting on Ruby Hill in Denver, watching this wall of water coming down the Platte River.
She says the flood was so strong it was carrying horses from a nearby racetrack. After that, Douglas County joined forces with its neighbors. All three hug the major city of Denver, and together they're a mixture of blue and red, urban and rural. And for decades, they've been in love. But now, Laura Thomas is not a kid sitting on a hill watching a flood. She's a county commissioner up for re-election, and she says the relationship just isn't working. It's time her county, which is rich and conservative compared to its neighbors, moved on.
We're ready to move out on our own.
The trouble began with a stay-at-home order.
We actually received several emails from citizens saying we need to have our own health department.
The mask mandate a few months later made things worse.
You know, we wouldn't want some other state coming in and telling Colorado what to do. And that is where Douglas County is. We don't want Adams County and Arapahoe County citizens dictating to us our very personal, important public health decisions.
So in the summer, they announced they intend to break off and form their own health department. They've backpedaled a bit since then and are talking with the other counties. But going rogue is still on the table.
We did receive a letter.
Emma Pinter is a commissioner for one of the other counties in the health department, Adams County. Compared to Douglas, it's lower income and more progressive. And Pinter is visibly irritated about what's going on.
Historically, this has been very collaborative. The issues were common. Opioid addiction, youth suicide, mental health generally, access to public health, access to medical care, the cost of medical care.
If Douglas County really wanted to leave, Pinter says, why didn't this come up before?
To have this conversation at a time when it is so critical that we are responsive and that our health department is responsive is a distraction.
Pinter says this isn't about public health. It's about partisan politics. The Center for Sharing Public Health Services is dedicated to getting health departments to work together. Charlie Hunt works there. He's the deputy director and an epidemiologist.
It really is more about being able to deliver more effective and more efficient services.
He says there's a spectrum of sharing. Some health departments just share a little, like supplies or data. To run with the relationship analogy, that's on the friends with benefits end of the spectrum. But the Tri-County Health Department is a full merger. It is like a marriage. But instead of planning a 55th anniversary bash, this trio is talking about divorce. Hunt isn't aware of other public health marriages falling apart right now, but he says the system is under more strain than ever. And politics alone shouldn't do the marriage in, he says, but it's understandable how the pandemic may be prying them apart.
One of the success factors or prerequisites even is to have a shared regional identity. But it stands to reason that if there are differences in philosophies, differences in ideology, that there are going to be some tensions created because of that.
What's happening here is not unique.
That's Jennifer Ludwig, deputy director of this troubled marriage, aka the Tri-County Health Department. She says this pandemic really yanked public health out of its happy place.
Nobody had ever seen public health in the light. We're always in the background. It's one of those things that, you know, if you don't see us, you're doing a good job. This put public health in the limelight, front and center, in the best and worst possible way.
She says if Douglas County broke off, that would have a huge impact on their ability to respond to the pandemic. Plus,
my time has absolutely been pulled from the pandemic to focus on this. And if we were to lose staff, even if it's next summer, we will still be in the middle of a response.
She and her colleagues are rooting for the marriage to make it so they can get back to work and public health can go back to being invisible. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ray Ellen Bichel.
Libby Montana was already living with an invisible enemy that attacks your lungs long before COVID-19 reached our shores. For the past century, asbestos has killed hundreds in this small town, at least. As our Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie reports, that experience informs how it's reacting today.
Frank Phelan has been slowly building his dream house near Libby, Montana for the past 15 years.
It's an Amish log home with a beautiful stain on it and the best back deck you've ever seen in your whole life.
It overlooks pine-forested foothills and an open meadow where deer and coyotes roam. And ever since the pandemic ramped up in mid-March, Phelan has been spending most days up here, away from people. That's because, like a lot of folks in Libby, he's vulnerable to COVID-19. His lungs are scarred from breathing in asbestos-laced dust from a nearby mine for decades.
Feels like somebody's standing on your chest. Or almost like somebody stuffed a pillow down there in your lung.
Phelan is 61 years old, but even climbing up a small hill near his house is hard. He reaches for his inhaler.
Magic stuff. Albuterol. Pound that stuff down.
Phelan says he can manage the symptoms, but he believes his lungs aren't strong enough to fight off COVID-19. So he's staying away from town. He hasn't visited his son and granddaughter in months, and...
Hadn't it been for COVID, my will would not be written. But it is now, and it's filed in the courthouse, and the whole goddamn thing is all done. That gives you some idea how seriously I take this.
A few miles away from Phelan's dream house, Miles Miller sees patients like Phelan every week at a small ranch-style medical center in town.
Our patients having an underlying lung disease would make recovery from COVID-19 more difficult.
Miller has lived in Libby, Montana since 1990. That was the year the vermiculite mine that caused this public health disaster finally closed down. Before that, Miller says, the mine spewed asbestos-laden dust throughout Libby, constantly.
During the heyday, I don't think you could shop for groceries in this town without breathing some of the dust.
And it can take decades for someone to develop health problems from breathing in that dust. Miller says about 1 in 10 residents in the Libby area are currently diagnosed with an asbestos-related disease, which can be anything from scarred lungs to various cancers. But when it comes to COVID, so far the town has been somewhat spared. Miller chalks that up to the community taking the pandemic seriously from the get-go, with widespread testing, contact tracing, and quarantining.
Had we not been very stringent with that, it could have been devastating.
Most people here are resigned to the various restrictions, including masks and social distancing. But for a few, the town's history with the mine and the government's initial inaction has made them wary of authority.
They profiteered off our precious lives and souls.
That's Doug Shaw. His lungs are scarred from asbestos. And during our conversation, he rails against the state government and the mine's owner, W.R. Grace & Company, for covering up the contamination here for decades.
I do not like what they did to us here and allowed to be done to us.
He calls it murder. And that distrust of authority has bled into his reaction to COVID-19. He questions the science and is frustrated by the restrictions.
Nobody has to live like this. We need to get back to work.
That sentiment runs strong throughout Northwest Montana. It's a conservative region with a libertarian streak, and Libby's economy relies on summer visitors. And this has led to a paradox. On one hand, local officials in the community have largely accepted public health guidelines. But on the other, the county is allowing big public events like a rodeo and an international chainsaw competition. Julie Kendall isn't pleased about that.
These people that come to these events from out of town are going to our gas stations, our grocery stores, and they could be exposing you right there.
She's a phlebotomist at the local hospital. She was also diagnosed with an asbestos-related disease a couple of months ago. She figures she got it as a kid from the piles of mine waste next to the local swimming pool. Kendall sees parallels between asbestos and COVID-19.
It's unseen. You don't see it. You can be doing the innocentest thing, and it could still get you.
But Kendall also believes those parallels have given folks like her a leading edge on dealing with this pandemic because they've been here before.
We're already afraid here. So it's kind of like one more shake of the dice. I don't know how else to say that. You can't live every day in fear, but here we do.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
a moment, Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim and WyoFile's Andrew Graham join me to discuss an investigative story about a behind-the-scenes effort by Wyoming to extend the life of coal plants in other states. This is Open Spaces.
Five years ago, we asked ourselves, what if we made a show that sounds like a storyteller speaking to you, that strips everything down to what happens next? What if we made a podcast about where humans and our habitat meet?
Here's mysteries you didn't even realize were still out there.
I'm Erin Jones. 5 years worth of human nature is waiting for you under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming has re-upped its contract with a nonprofit called the Energy Policy Network. The group is engaged with 9 states in an effort to extend the life of coal plants set to close early. But controversy has followed the group, and they're not required to reveal their backing from Wyoming, and often don't. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim and WyoFile's Andrew Graham explore the tactics and ethics behind the state's use of a 501c4, often derided as dark money group, in an online investigation. So, Andrew, let's start with some background. What do we know about this group called the Energy Policy Network, and why does Wyoming fund them?
The Energy Policy Network is a nonprofit that advocates for coal. It was founded in 2015 by Kelly Mader, who is a former Wyoming State Senator who went on to a long career in the coal industry. Today, it's run by Randy Eminger, who's the CEO. And essentially, the state and Kelly felt that other states were making policies that were impacting Wyoming's coal industry, and that there was need for Wyoming to find a way to get a voice in those fights abroad, if you will. EPN is often pitched as an alternative to the Sierra Club. The Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign works to close power plants around the country. And so EPN is suggested as a much smaller way to balance the message, if you will. The state says that this work is successful, that EPN has kept a number of power plants open, and they calculate that it's saved $38.5 million in coal revenues a year.
So, Cooper, the nonprofit is going into other states with the express goal of preserving the Powder River Basin coal. So how do they go about this, and what's their strategy?
So they're active in about 9 states, mostly in the Midwest and the South, though Colorado as well. If a plan that takes PRB coal is threatening to shut down early, the group generally has a game plan, has some strategies to go about tackling that, building a coalition, economic research, hiring a regulatory team, intervening, litigating if necessary. So these coalition groups have attracted quite a bit of controversy as well, because they're called things like Arkansas Affordable Energy Coalition, Indiana Coalition for Affordable and Reliable Electricity, and Wyoming's funding is not really made clear, or the backing from the Energy Policy Network is not clear. And for locals, they're often surprised, and it's either come out through the media or watchdog groups or other organizations who've sort of ground-truthed it to find out that that's where the backing came from. So that point came up at a recent press conference, actually, with Deputy Director of the Wyoming Energy Authority, Jason Baker.
I guess Wyoming has never been shy about its involvement, but certainly has never given EPN the okay to go ahead and talk about its relationship with Wyoming.
So why is this an important issue for Wyoming residents?
The controversy around this group, as I mentioned, is that EPN often doesn't identify itself. It's creating these local coalitions so that it can engage and intervene in regulatory proceedings to try to stop these early closures. Beyond that, their classification is as a 501c4 nonprofit, which is often correlated with dark money. It's typically used by corporations, wealthy individuals, foundations, because they can pour tons of money and not have to disclose their backers. So one expert on money and politics named Chara Torres-Spellacy was surprised to hear a state was involved in this type of political activity.
This is the first time that someone has
said that a state itself, as in one of the 50 states, is the source of dark money spending. So this is a new one for me. It is a little bit troubling that one state might use the subterfuge of dark money to compete with its sister states in a way that is not above board.
After speaking with many folks involved in nonprofit political action, that is a pretty common theme. A former chief White House ethics lawyer went as far as to say, this is something a state should not be doing. The state itself says, look, we know this is unusual, but a lot of Wyoming coal is at stake here, and it's not a heavy investment for the amount of money that they believe that they are saving.
So, Andrew, you've both been reporting on this for weeks. What are some of the big discoveries that you've made?
Yeah, this was a pretty in-depth investigation, and I definitely encourage folks to go to Wildfowl or Wyoming Public Media's websites and read the story. Among our findings were, importantly, we found that Wyoming is EPN's biggest single funder. So that raises questions for us about how much control Wyoming should have over this nonprofit. And what we found was that it wasn't clear who's calling the shots. The director of EPN, Randy Eminger, seemed to feel that he had pretty wide leeway to, he gets these donations and then he goes out and he does what he's going to do, which goes back to those ethical questions of what a state should be involved in. Another finding we found comes back to that number that we quoted at the beginning, that $38.5 million in revenues. There's reasons to question that return on investment, which is what state officials point to when they talk about why they're engaged in this. There's kind of two things. One, it's based on four plants staying open longer than at one point they were proposed for closure. And so one thing is that a lot of folks who worked to close those plants cast doubt on how much EPN actually played a role in keeping them open. So that's one way to question that return of investments. The other thing is whether it's even working. We found that by looking at federal energy data, even if these plants stay open, they might be burning less coal than they were in the past, whereas that figure is kind of calculated on them maintaining the coal consumption they had before. But especially this year, 2020, with its economic slowdown from COVID, the data we're showing shows that these plants are burning between 70 and 50% less coal in the first half of 2020 than they were in the first half of 2018. That raises the question of maybe Wyoming is keeping plants open, but the same level of coal and thus the same level of tax revenue isn't being maintained.
Very interesting story. Cooper McKim, again, of Wyoming Public Radio, and Andrew Graham of Wyofile joining us. Wyofile has the story, as does our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Good work, gentlemen, and thank you. Now let's turn our attention to science. Over 100 years ago, every decade, trillions of Rocky Mountain locusts, a type of grasshopper, would swarm through the Rocky Mountain West. Now extinct, these locusts have been found frozen in mountain glaciers. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kadowska follows two researchers who are trekking the Beartooth Mountain glaciers to document them and the long-lost insect.
Oh, we are leaving base camp here at Little Goose Lake, and we are going to head up to Grasshopper Glacier.
Draper Natural History Museum Assistant Curator Corey Anko leads the charge, and biologist Jordan Harrison follows behind on a trail in an alpine meadow. 3-foot wildflowers surround us, and just ahead, a field of rocks.
So maybe a mile and a half, maybe 2 miles, we'll see. We're heading up to a saddle. And it should be, we'll see what's on the other side.
On the other side of the saddle should be Grasshopper Glacier, the last time its size was documented over 40 years ago by one researcher, It was estimated to be about 5 miles long.
There it is. Right below us, you can see a light discoloration of the rocks where the snow and ice that was above the glacier from the winter has melted off. And looking further down slope, if you imagine how this glacier used to extend out 5 miles.
But now it's not one consistent chunk. Harrison estimates it's about a mile. We start walking down to the middle of the glacier.
There's living grasshoppers on the glacier right now, and they're really cold, so they're not moving. And you can imagine just a visualization here of modern grasshoppers coming down, landing on this glacier, and if we had gotten a snowstorm overnight, they might very well have been entombed as well.
Grasshopper Glacier is named that because when it was first documented, they also found thousands of frozen Rocky Mountain locusts. But Anko says as the glacier has been receding, these deposits have disappeared.
The rumor is that many of the, if not all of the grasshoppers, or these extinct locusts, the Rocky Mountain locusts, have washed out of the Grasshopper Glacier already.
And this is why Anko and Harrison are here. They want to document both the glacier and possibly the Rocky Mountain locust, who at one point, with the right conditions, swarmed the West in trillions. UW professor and grasshopper expert Jeff Lockwood says before Europeans arrived, the Rocky Mountain locust was a food source, but white settlers didn't enjoy them as much.
They were absolutely devastating to the crops. A swarm of locusts could reduce a farmer's field to basically bare dirt in a few hours.
In the late 1800s, a locust swarm could mean starvation for the settlers. As the swarms moved through mountain valleys, Lockwood says the wind would change and some would be deposited.
And so you can imagine them getting deposited on the ice, and then relatively quickly, because their bodies are dark, they're going to sort of melt into the snow cover, right? And they're going to be immobilized. They're cold-blooded. So they're stuck and they're going to die. They're going to freeze.
The issue was so dire that the federal government got involved in solving the locust swarm problem. But then, all of a sudden, the swarms stopped on their own. That was in the beginning of the 20th century, and nobody knew why. Lockwood says, it turns out that fertile river valleys were being converted into agricultural fields, ridding the habitat of the Rocky Mountain locust egg beds.
If you cut enough of the strands of the net, eventually it falls apart. And we think that's what happened to the Rocky Mountain locust, as you know, we sometimes say, you know, a bunch of unwitting farmers armed with cows and plows, you know, wiped out, you know, the greatest threat to agriculture in the Western United States without knowing what they were doing.
Back at Grasshopper Glacier, Harrison leans down, his nose almost touching the ice, and carefully shovels out what looks like a black speck. He pours water over it.
Definitely not recent, you know.
Yeah, man, he looks like you can see a leg here.
Yeah, it might be part of one.
Yeah. So what we're looking at here is, it appears to be like an invertebrate that looks severely flattened and at an advanced stage of decay, but there are some somewhat identifiable characteristics, like one piece looks kind of like a leg, segment of a leg.
We continue looking around, but don't find any full intact specimens. For Anko and Harrison, the trip was still a success. To them, these glaciers tell a story that they want to share.
So it's a story that not only tells the history of the biology and the ecology of the area, but also what that impact was to human life at this time. And that helps to connect us a little bit more to this landscape.
And they will continue searching throughout the Beartooth Mountain glaciers for a Rocky Mountain locust specimen, while also documenting the glaciers themselves. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kodelska at Grasshopper Glacier.
Alexis Barney teaches 4th and 5th grade at Evansville Elementary School in Casper. And this year, the Wyoming Department of Education has announced Barney is the state's 2021 Teacher of the Year. Barney says she's humbled to receive the award and views it as a privilege to represent the state's teachers. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler spoke with Barney about how she's been focusing on her students' mental health, especially since the pandemic.
This whole climate that our country and our world are facing totally changes education. We've seen a big change in education, and we know that there's a lot of limitations now. I want to believe that rather than dwelling on those limitations, those obstacles, those barriers, I don't think we can let them deter us. I think teachers can use them as tools to create memorable educational experiences for their students. Instead of seeing these things as walls, such as, oh, I can't teach in person, I need to teach online, or, I mean, even something as simple as we've had to change the entire way we're teaching. No more paper materials. We have to go towards using the computer. My students aren't as comfortable with a computer. That's a barrier. But instead of seeing them as limitations, I think we can find a silver lining that we can work with in order to turn our can'ts into cans and make magic in different ways. It's going to look different. It's going to be totally different, and that's okay.
How is it going teaching under these circumstances now? You know, whether that includes like a pivot to online, or, you know, with these new standards that we have for in-person teaching.
It's been a learning curve for both myself and my students. And so I think there's a time where as educators, we have to say, what is more important? What's the priority? Is it that the students are able to come to school or to attend class, whether that's in person or online, and feel valued and feel recognized and that their emotional needs are met? Or is it that we are hammering the academics and trying to make up for all of the lost time? And I think the former is the priority. We need to slow down, and as educators, we need to recognize that those students need emotional support, and we have to take slower steps to get them to the point where we know that they can succeed. And that's not always academic. That might be, how are you today? Are you doing okay? Can we talk about it? Okay. Or even technology. Technology is totally different now. And so taking those smaller steps to get them used to technology, getting them used to the new way of learning, and then the academics will come. We have to build those relationships and those connections with students to make them feel and let them know that they are valued, and to let them know that we're here for them and we care about them before they can start learning. And that's whether we're in a global pandemic or not. But now more than ever, that's extremely important.
Yeah. And what are some of the ways you're approaching that in your classroom?
I'm approaching this through having a lot of conversations with my students, really working hard to make those connections. I loop with my students. So I have them for 2 years. I have them for fourth grade and then again in fifth grade. And I know that if I set that foundation now by connecting with them and really building that relationship and taking the time to build that relationship both as a classroom family but also one-on-one with each and every individual, not only am I making them feel valued, but I'm showing them that I'm here, I care for them, and I'm really working to help them build those social emotional tools that will help them get through this. That comes through a lot of conversations, a lot of journal writings, talking about scenarios, role playing, things like that.
Are you seeing efforts, you know, along that, you know, mental and emotional health side coming along maybe in your school or district or even the state?
I think a lot of people are recognizing that and able to kind of slow things down and say, okay, let's talk about feelings. Let's talk about emotions. Let's talk about coping. Let's talk about resilience. Let's talk about how this whole COVID situation has affected you, and now how can we move forward? Or how is it maybe still affecting you, and how can we cope with that? How can we become resilient? That's been a huge conversation with educators, is not only how can we promote that resilience in our students, but how can we help families as well? And how can we bring our entire learning community together, parents, students, and teachers, in order to get through this in the most positive way that we can?
Alexis Barney teaches 4th and 5th grade at Evansville Elementary School in Casper and was selected as the 2021 Wyoming Teacher of the Year. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
In a moment, we will wrap up our program by discussing a fun new podcast by kids. This is Open Spaces.
How did the Rocky Mountains form? Well, the point in Wyoming.
How would we keep Wyoming the way it is while still moving forward?
Welcome to the Kids Ask Why podcast,
where kids ask the questions.
For the first season of the Kids Ask Why podcast, Wyoming kids tell us why they think Wyoming is special.
Public lands,
wildlife, bears, and wolves.
Find Kids Ask Why under podcast at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Tuesday, a brand new podcast will be available showcasing issues Wyoming kids are interested in. The podcast was developed by the Buffalo Bill Center of the West and Wyoming Public Media. The producer is our own Camila Kudelska. Camila, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me here today.
So what's the name of this, and tell us a little bit about it.
So it's called Kids Ask Why podcast, and it's a podcast that's geared towards giving the power to kids the age between 7 and 13. So kids are asking adults questions about what they're interested in, and our first season's theme is Why is Wyoming Special to Them? We've had a lot of different topics from wildlife to open spaces to geology and just the community of Wyoming.
Where'd you get the idea to do a kids podcast?
So I've always thought that there's a lack of content for kids in the podcast world, and I kind of wanted to fill that void. So me and the team of center educators brainstormed what was lacking in that field and what we could provide as museum educators and as a reporter. And we realized maybe the best thing might be to give the power to the kids and let them ask the questions. So we're hoping it can help provide parents and children with education on how kids think and what they want to learn about.
So what does it sound like?
So again, the whole podcast surrounds around the idea that the kids are taking charge. So each episode features at least two kids, again, between the ages of 7 and 13, who ask adults questions. And it can be experts or just a family friend or anyone who they want to ask questions. Like I said, for the first season, it's about what they think makes Wyoming special.
So tell us a little bit about this first episode.
The first episode, we have a seven-year-old girl named Bee and a 10-year-old boy named Keller, and they're answering the question, why are people attracted to Wyoming? And Bee answered snow, and she's a little seven-year-old, and she has so much energy, and it was really hard for her to sit down and just be still. But when we finally did get her to sit down and ask her expert some questions, her questions were really unique, like this one.
Can snow push stuff down into the ground?
What stuff? Like bugs?
Maybe houses?
Grass? Well...
While Keller was kind of an opposite of Bee, he was quiet, calm, but also curious, and he really wanted to learn about why Old Faithful erupts in the same intervals.
When did scientists start timing Old Faithful, and how do they know when it is about to go off?
So the timing really started maybe about the time that Langford visited Old Faithful, about the time, you know, 1870, with this group called the Washburn Expedition.
So I just really love the dynamic between the two of them, which I hope our listeners do as well. And the rest of the episodes also have just, you know, a really interesting dynamic between the kids, which is really fun.
So who are some of the experts that join you?
We have experts, a full range of experts. We have geologists, we have Wyoming Game and Fish Department biologists. We have the former senator of Wyoming, Al Simpson. So it's a really wide range of people that are willing to talk to kids.
What, again, was some of the most memorable moments working on the podcast?
I think it's really the interaction between the kids and the adult. For one episode, like I mentioned, we had former U.S. Senator Al Simpson speak with Sam. And there's a moment where the phone rings in Al Simpson's office. And, you know, just the interaction between Sam and Al is pretty amazing.
We need some bears over here. So many moths outside.
Oh, well, we'll send some grizzlies down there. They'll eat them for you. That's right. That's your phone. I'm not going to answer it. It's your teacher calling to ask me some more questions.
And then there was the moment when one of our kids who was interested in Liz Bird got so excited to see her face on like one of the flags on the UW campus. She made her mom take a picture of her with it and then sent it to our whole team. So it was also, it was just really gratifying to see them learn about what they wanted to know throughout the whole process.
So where do people find the podcast?
So people can find it on kidsaskwhy.org or wherever they get podcasts. So that can be Spotify, Google, Apple, anywhere.
The name of the podcast is Kids Ask Why. We've been chatting with Camila Kudelska. Great work on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. We have started our fall fundraising campaign. Please do your part to support this program and our Wyoming News effort with your pledge on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. And while you're there, you can check out this entire show or individual segments, or even sign up for our podcast. That's also available wherever you get your podcasts. Our segments are also available via social media, including our station Facebook page. Anna Rader is our web editor. I'd also like to mention that we are always looking for good ideas for future stories as well as interviews. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.